Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast, the official Back to School Week podcast, podcast 410, the new talk, the Bob Davis Podcasts. So in podcast 410, I want to ask a question, and this is something that I was thinking about the other day. Once again, I'm loving doing podcasts about stuff that isn't necessarily in the headlines. There are enough people doing update stuff for you to be updated on news and the headlines. I want to talk about stuff that occurs to me that I think is behind the headlines a little bit, because I'm still reading the news and I'm still aware of what is going on. I just think it's really fun and more useful to talk about things that are kind of going on in the background. And my question is, are we in an era of bad or forgotten presidents and congresses, political shuffle, political party shuffling and updating, and voter evolution? And what exactly does that mean? We're going to talk about that in podcast 410. I've been talking about the weather, and it's, you know, I have a cold. It's getting colder, supposedly. Somebody told me tonight that I spent way too long at dinner yelling and talking, and somebody told me at dinner, hey, you know, it's going to get cold. Like, it's going to get cold soon. Like, the high is going to be 60. And I just shriveled. But this period of time and the just passed state fair are cues. And they are cues that the close of summer is coming fast and winter is coming, as they say on the TV show Game of Thrones. Greg Ryan of Ryan Plumbing and Heating wants you guys to know that this is the time to have Ryan Plumbing and Heating come out and check your heating system. And here's why. It's not just to see if it works. You know, that's important, but that's not the real reason. I mean, they can check the water heater, they can check the heating system. But today, it's all about integrating smart tech with your heating systems to make them more efficient. And if you haven't had your heating system upgraded in the last 5 years, and Ryan upgrades you, you can actually save a lot of money during the mini ice age that we call winter. So here's what you do. Call Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. You call Ryan Plumbing and have him come out and check your heating system. You'd be surprised how much you can save through higher efficiencies because of smart tech. And they go all over the metro from St. Paul. And of course, that means the suburbs too. Invergrove, you know, Maple Grove, all the groves, and of course, Plymouth and St. Louis Park and so on, Minnetonka. For four generations, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business, Ryan Plumbing and Heating. They're on University Avenue in St. Paul, just west of the state capitol, where they've always been. You can also call them for emergency service, and you may need that too this winter. I just hate saying that. 651-224-4771, the winter part. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Metro-wide from St. Paul for over 60 years, Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Now, in this podcast, I want to thank the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis Podcast, Alpha Systems. If you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Here's what you do. You click on the Alpha Systems banner for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. And thanks, guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Well, before I begin this, I want to do a quick disclaimer on history. And I've still got a little bit of this cold, so I might have some clearing of the throat and some coughing, or my voice might just crack. It's weird. It's this weird illness that everybody has right now. But it's on the wane, so that's all good. But you know, most people who know me know that my favorite subject is history, which I am self-educated on. And so a lot of times when I talk about history, it's not academic in the sense that I didn't go to, you know, I don't have a master's degree in history or a doctorate in history in a particular era. So it's hard for me to talk academically about history, because for me, it's just piecing together, you know, different stories from different books that I read. And, you know, there's always new information coming out about any era. And this new information is updated. And most of us today, just to jog our memory, will go to Wikipedia, which is a terrible... In fact, Wikipedia will not... If you're in college and you write a paper, you can't source Wikipedia. They want you to go to the source material. Well, for a podcast, I'm not going to go to the source material. You know, if I want to make a point about history, which I'm going to do in this podcast, it's really to provoke some thinking on your part and maybe some research on your part and some of the conclusions I might draw from some of these eras that I'm going to talk about. In particular, this era between 1836 and 1860, really, some people might have issues with, but it's based on some broad brush strokes about accomplishments by what I would refer to as the forgotten presidents or the era of the forgotten presidents. Now, different people call different eras or they have lists for forgotten presidents, which kind of hop around. And what I think about this particular era is we've forgotten it because it was not very good at all. But this would be for me, for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to call it that period in American history from the end of the administration of President Jackson, Andrew Jackson, to the beginning of the administration of Abraham Lincoln. So in between the two guys on the $5 and $20 bill, basically. And you'll say, well, what happened? And here's a list of what happened. Martin Van Buren, William Henry Harrison, John Tyler, James K. Polk, Zachary Taylor, Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan happened. And if you ask somebody like me, who isn't steeped in all this all the time, to recite a list of the presidents, you kind of go George Washington, Jefferson, Adams, and then there was a guy in there named Monroe, and then John Quincy Adams, and then Jackson, and then Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Johnson, you know, U.S. Grant, Roosevelt, you know. So there are people that you forget, and this is probably the longest list of quote-unquote forgotten presidents, or presidents that really didn't accomplish much. I mean, there's presidents like Coolidge, who's forgotten today, but Coolidge was actually an effective president, you know, historically and economically. So especially people, again, revising the history of Coolidge. But we're going to focus on this period between 1836 or so, and 1856, 57, 58, just before Lincoln took office. Now, this is not a podcast done with the intention of blaming all of these presidents for the Civil War, but just to provoke thoughts among subscribers and listeners regarding just what kind of era that we're living through today and what that means. And it's interesting, though, that this period of forgotten presidents, men who, for the most part, served one term or less, except for a couple who served really no term, you know, one who lived only a month as president, struggled to meet their own agenda and the goals for their presidency. I think probably Polk was the most effective. Maybe it was Polk or... I would say Polk was the most effective of all of those presidents in terms of getting what they wanted done, such as it was. This was an era marked by misunderstandings, political disagreements, social discord, and upheaval as, you know, young America pushed west and we struggled to deal with the slavery issue. And all of this challenged the status quo as the country grew and the government struggled to keep up. That's probably the best way to describe it. As you look at this period, you kind of have to wonder whether the people had a sense of the lack of leadership or whether it was just quite happy with Martin Van Buren or James Buchanan at the time. So let's take a quick look at some of these presidencies. Martin Van Buren was a former senator, secretary of state, and vice president for Jackson. And when he took office in 1837, was essentially blamed for an economic depression, which was a depression ignited by excessive debt because of expansion and all sorts of monetary issues, and was voted out after one term. William Henry Harrison succeeded Van Buren and died just after 1 month in office. You know, normally I'd mention the fact that these were Democrats or Whigs, but the party was not as important here as the individual presidents. John Tyler was Harrison's vice president and established the succession precedent by simply taking the office and moving into the White House after Harrison died, earning him the title His Excellency. Tyler, you know, at the time there was no, is it the 20, I forget which amendment it is, may it be the 22nd Amendment that establishes the succession for the presidency. And Tyler, there was no precedent. He just took over as president. Now, Tyler was a supporter of states' rights, but he annexed the Texas Territory and generally supported nationalist policy as long as he felt it didn't impinge on the authority of states. He was a Virginian. He's best known for Western expansion of this country at the time, but embroiled in controversy with both major parties at the time, his own ambition and the ambition of his potential opponents, and was pretty much sidelined through much of his presidency, very ineffective. James K. Polk, I mentioned, was probably more effective than any of these other guys, best known for the Mexican-American War and final acts in the acquisition of Texas, California, the Southwestern territories. Some have called him the strongest pre-war, pre-Civil War president, but he compromised on the slavery issue, essentially kicking that can down the road. Zachary Taylor is one of the most interesting of this group of presidents. He was a Mexican war hero, major general, who everyone thought was a dunce, but a great fighter, which is confusing to me, but this was his rep. But he proved to be well-read and prepared for the presidency, to the surprise of those who had put him up for the office, and even to the outgoing President Polk, who thought he was completely unprepared. Taylor, I happened to just read a book. I just had a bunch of books on presidents, and I read a book on him, knowing really nothing about him. He was a major slaveholder in the United States at the time, but he was one of these people who felt very strongly that he wasn't going to allow the country to break up over the issue. He served for only 17 months, but there is one good story regarding Taylor and the secessionist Southern senators. I think this was Taylor. It may have been Jackson, but it may have happened to both men. The Southern delegation went over to the president, or they were talking about secession, and he called them over to the White House late at night. And when they showed up, he had his sword. He said, you know, if you secede, you guys are the first people I will shoot. And that was the end of that. Millard Fillmore was an anti-slavery moderate who supported the Compromise of 1850, which, to be extremely brief, with a broad-based brush, allowed the territories acquired in the Mexican-American War, which is controversial anyway, to come into the Union as free states and allowed others, like Utah, to decide for themselves whether to be free or slave. This ended a five-year standoff between slave and free states concerning the status of new territories added in the West, and in my view, kicked the can of slavery down the road again. Franklin Pierce was a Northern Democrat who saw abolitionists as a threat to the Republic and enforced the Fugitive Slave Act and the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which annulled the Missouri Compromise, you know, creating the problem all over again. And then James Buchanan took office as the battle intensified over slavery, and he would not abolish it, and he would not go to war over it, thinking both illegal. In other words, he felt that both would have been illegal for him to do something about, but really he was very timid and all the time talking about the rule of law, and basically didn't do anything, even though at this point what the country needed was decisive action on the issue. And that set the stage for what I view as the greatest calamity in U.S. history, really, which was the Civil War, and that left Lincoln to solve these problems with very little support. So he really struggled as president. Now, again, these are very light sketches of the presidencies of these men. A lot happened during their presidencies. But it seems to me that the country needed very different kinds of leaders during the time between Van Buren's election in 1836, and Buchanan's in 1856. And it was just, when you think about this, it was just a 20-year time period. But what a significant period of time that turned out to be. So if you graduated high school in 1996, it's only been 20 years since that time period. So in 2016, we're going to elect a new president. And as I have been discussing in these podcasts, I think the assessment of the so-called pundits and experts are deeply lacking in depth and context and very long an analysis of the obvious and the current. And I think we need to take a step back, and I think we need to think about what the country needs and what we're missing that the country needs right now. that period of time from 1836 to 1856 strikes me as a time when things that needed to be done weren't able to be done for whatever reason. So I'm not blaming any one of these presidents or the people or Congress for you, you know, it's your fault that this happened. It's just that there was a sort of blindness to how to solve these problems. We did not solve the slavery question, and what was left was paralyzing partisan fights in Congress over every acquisition and territory going forward. Probably the single most significant policy failure of U.S. history, none of which solved the slavery question, leading again to the greatest calamity in our history, the Civil War. Especially when you consider the fact that in the antebellum South, most people did not own slaves. So this was really something that could have been solved and should have been solved and wasn't. And I'm not saying I would have been able to solve it. And again, I'm not blaming them for not solving it. But look what happened during that period of time. Nothing got done. And as a result, it got worse and worse and worse. But in reading about presidents in this period of time, you know, I'm not sure that they were paying too much attention to what the country needed. I think they were focused instead on office seekers acquiring new territory through treaty and war. And Taylor's example was that when he took office, he exhausted himself dealing with office seekers who literally crowded every room in the White House. Same was true with William Henry Harrison. This guy was president. He was sick. He had, you know, pneumonia, and he could not rest because the White House, literally every room of the White House, was full of these office seekers. So 20 years ago, in 1996, Bill Clinton was president, and the economy was essentially booming, and nobody was really thinking about the deeper challenges facing the United States. If you think of the Reagan era as sort of the era of good feeling that preceded Bill Clinton's presidency, the era of good feeling that preceded Andrew Jackson's presidency, so it's sort of a weak analogy if history's repeating itself. You could think of Clinton as a modern-day Andrew Jackson, but people look at his presidency and say, oh, it was perfect, but there were blind challenges that became obvious just 5 years later on September 11th, 2001. So I think it would be a good thought experiment to spend some time on what the country might actually need today that the politicians, potential presidents, and really the media are missing in 2016. Well, I'm talking about history in this podcast, and as you know, all through history, it's demonstrated that one of the paths to personal wealth is to own properties through property ownership. Many continue to rent while waiting to purchase their first home or move up to their next home. In the last 5 years or so, there's been many foreclosures and houses sitting empty for extended periods of time and houses renovated for fly-by-night and by fly-by-night house flippers. And, you know, I've been talking about getting a real estate sponsor to the Bob Davis podcast because to negotiate that risk, you need real estate professionals that understand the market. Now, interest rates have been near historically low levels for many years. You know, if you've been reading the news, that there's pressure to increase interest rates. In fact, the Fed may increase interest rates at their September meeting. So this is the time to take advantage of low interest rates if you're in the market for real estate or someone close to you is considering buying their first home. So I want to introduce prideofhomes.com to listeners and subscribers to the Bob Davis podcast. Prideofhomes.com, a husband and wife licensed real estate agent team and real estate investors with expertise to share with you. Take a minute and talk with Eric and Aram Lucero with Luke Team Real Estate and prideofhomes.com. They are in the North and Northwest. West Metro, Maple Grove, Plymouth, Rogers, Dayton, Champlin, Albertville, St. Michael, Elk River, and the North Metro Corridor. If you want real estate expertise, Eric and Aram Lucero with Luke Team Real Estate can help you out. Visit their website today at prideofhomes.com, or you can click on the banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcasts, 763-433-9100. That's 763-433-9100. And thanks you guys for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcasts. Now, first off, my immediate impression of this period between 1836 and 1856 is the weakness of the executive branch of the American government, coupled with weak presidents, you know, constitutionally weak presidents. I don't mean the Constitution of the United States. I mean mentally weak presidents for whatever reason. And this is something Lincoln fixed to a degree by expanding the power of the presidency during the Civil War. But being a strong man, he became essentially a dictator to do this. I think a lot of people wonder why the leaders at the time couldn't solve the question of slavery and head the problem off at the pass before it became the issue of the century and perhaps for all time in U.S. history. And I don't have an answer for that, but I think a lot of the action at the time was in the U.S. Senate and Congress, and it hamstrung weak presidents anyway. It kind of reminds me of Congress these days, and really, even though the presidency in this country is considerably stronger, we have a Congress, House and Senate, long in procedure, weak on action, and when action is taken, it's not necessarily the right thing, and sometimes it's absolutely the wrong thing. And we have presidents kind of doing a lot through executive action to get around, you know, these Congresses that don't seem to be able to solve any problems. And the question, the first question is whether or not we're in one of these dangerous periods. Well, I would ask whether or not we've solved the economic problems brought about through debt and regulation of the 90s, the early 2000s, and most recently 2008. And you'd have to say probably not. And more regulation didn't solve those problems. I would ask, what is the economic philosophy that drives the country? Are we making progress resolving, whether it's focused on government intervention or is it going to be a free market orientation, and which is better and why? And I wonder whether people can actually answer that question. Does the country have a clear path forward in terms of national goals besides rhetoric? I would have to say no. Do we have a clear policy regarding the rest of the world, defending our interests and borders and keeping the country secure, as well as protecting the rights of Americans? Is the government protecting the rights of us, the people, or in the effort to protect us, essentially impinging, imprisoning us, impinging on our rights? What are we doing about growing our communications capabilities from internet to transportation, including roads, air travel, even space travel? And a lot of people call this infrastructure. I don't really want to call it that because that makes people think that the government has to do it. But I mean, how do we create the structure to make that stuff, to make people able to work to bring that stuff into being, to manifest it? Is the legal structure accommodating new technology so that it can become a productive part of the economy? Now, in the 1830s, it was trains and sea travel and waterways. Are we moving forward on these problems from a cohesive philosophical base, or is the country split between one group of interests who want to go in one way and another one that wants to go a completely different direction that aren't talking, aren't communicating, aren't working together, are pulling apart and pulling against each other? Another conclusion I drew from just a quick glance through this period of history is that I'm starting to understand or believe, and I'm asking this as a question, that maybe it isn't the personalities, the individual congressmen or senators or even presidents and judges that made up the work of government during this particular era, the 1840s, 50s, and whatever. Whether it's on civil rights or a war or the acquisition of territory, but is it political power that is in the hands of those who can influence the vote or elected and appointed officials in power? When you look at the political action groups that characterize this era from 1836 to 1856, you see the northern industrial and merchant interests as one block and the southern agricultural interests as another block with completely different ideas about what to do and how to do what they needed to do. I wonder what individuals thought during this era while they were out accomplishing some of the amazing things that were done, whether it was heading to Oregon or California or other Western reaches, fighting in the wars, treating with Indians, working on these issues of freedom, exploring, buying, selling, and trading, or conducting business, or practicing law or medicine, or just farming or mining or inventing, because everyday people were in the process of doing everyday things that essentially were the building blocks of what came later, which was a great country. I just feel that we're missing an opportunity every day to bring on the development of the new world. And, this is a new world that's definitely coming just as fast and just as strong as the Industrial Revolution was bringing the world that occurred after the Civil War. It feels to me like the longer we wait to bring this new world forth, the more calamitous its arrival. Listen to some of the things people are talking about, whether it's artificial intelligence, you know, job disruption due to technology, space travel, food additives, you know, all these things. These are the building blocks of this new era. And if we can't solve these problems, they just will be thrust upon us. And the longer we wait to solve these problems, the more calamitous its arrival. As I said, there are things we need to do now that aren't Republican or Democrat, that aren't even on our radar, even on their radar, that do not involve these emotional, almost day-to-day issues, whether it's gay marriage that people are demonstrating about, sending illegals home, fighting ISIS or a treaty with Iran, or granting government benefits to the downtrodden, you know, whatever your issue. These are certainly important problems, but all the talk and organization around emotional day-to-day yelling and screaming and about the issues obscures what we need to get done, and it slows us down. And then you start asking, well, what do you think needs to be done? Do you think about the future 20 years from now? I think about it all the time. To me, it's the only issue. What's going to happen in 20 years and how do we get there? What's going to happen in 30 years and how do we get there? And where the policies we enact today and the inability to deal with the problems today, to really work on those building blocks for the future, could lead to serious problems at some point in the future that will set us back. And people say, well, what could that be? Well, you know, as my friend the investment banker said, and I tell this story all the time, I was like, what's the worst that could happen? And he said, well, the Depression, World War II, you know, where we would have had 1950s and 1960s in the 1930s and 40s, but we got set back 10 years because of an economic calamity. The reaction to it was worse than the economic, you know, breakdown. And then we had a world war because of a world economic calamity. This could happen today very easily. What kinds of ideas do you think about that aren't getting addressed? And I don't mean Syria or ISIS or the border. Again, these are important issues, but I'm talking about issues that can have long-term impact. What kinds of these initiatives are being ignored or not dealt with by Congress and presidents? And what kinds of issues are being flogged or the flames fanned for political support? And I could give you divisive examples, but I'm not going to. I almost did, but I'm gonna pass. I'm gonna let you come up with your own examples. Here's another question: how are your day-to-day dealings different from what the media and politicians say your day-to-day dealings are, or how are they the same? How can we reorganize politically? Let's call it reorienting politically around positive long-term policies in every relevant area. Now you say, well, what are some examples? Well, how does the government protect us and our rights without taking our rights away through mass surveillance and a police state capability, which is upsetting people? You know, both of those things are upsetting people on both ends of the political spectrum. How do we expect to raise new leaders with an education system that seems to be based on ideas that really are industrial? You know, they're not really modern ideas. Why do we have an air travel system that's also based on an industrial system with an air traffic control system that is from the 1950s, literally, when there is software and civilian aviation, Uber style, and a new air traffic control system on the shelf right now that could revolutionize air travel, and instead what we're doing is trying to put more bureaucracy in it, and in my opinion, we want to spend billions, trillions on, you know, high-speed rail instead of redoing the entire air traffic control system to accommodate these new technologies. Why is the so-called gig economy, where labor and producer or customer are connected through peer-to-peer software and make a deal online based on supply and demand or availability, being limited? Why are city governments and state governments and political movements impinging on this kind of new economy because they're afraid of it? Why is that happening? Why are individuals and corporations facing heavier and heavier regulation and taxation when they start new businesses, which slows them down? Why is the government sector, federal, state, and local, enlarging every year? And it uses capital diverted from more productive uses. So we have really great new technologies in business and on the shelf, and government is not one of them. Let's just put it that way. It's really not a new technology, and it doesn't do well using new technologies. Now, these are a few of my concerns, and when I mention them, I'm sure that you fire up a lot of your own concerns. The intention here is to get you to think differently about the future of the country rather than what the talking points and the politicians and the media seem to want to push, because they're reacting. It's not the bouncing ball. Once we start thinking this way and thinking differently, then we can start organizing around these ideas rather than ideas as a reaction to something that's been done or said or seen on television by one of the political opposite poles, as in the North and South Pole or the right or left pole. You hear all the time that people are tired of the same old rhetoric, right and left, but then they just go out and organize behind politicians who just keep on throwing out the same tired rhetoric rather than saying, let's reorganize and reorient around something new. Is it possible that we actually need a new political party in the United States that doesn't hew right or left or Democrat or Republican and focuses not necessarily on our social divisions, but on the art of the possible and the ideas that bring us together? And I hate to use that because it's a cliche, but bring young people, middle-aged people, and older people together with all kinds of people and all kinds of creeds and colors, blah, 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 seeking opportunity to grow together and work together to grow the country without the government solving all of our problems. Essentially a movement, a popular movement that focuses on liberty. Have you been bitching about things that this president, who may someday be a forgotten president, has done? Or are you talking about this kind of thing, thinking it differently at your local meetings? And if you have you discussed it this way? And if you have, this is what I'd be interested in hearing about, you know, thinking about it in a positive way. And in the last few weeks, I've kind of talked about this a little bit, about pushing the idea that this generation of Americans has to learn again how to work together so we don't have to learn that lesson the hard way, the way that our grandparents and parents did. And I'm talking about the World War II generation, that they didn't think World War II was going to happen, but it was thrust upon them because of policy mistakes. And I actually want listeners and subscribers of the Bob Davis podcast to answer the challenge, not by holding up the Constitution, which is fine if you want to do that. I mean, I'm not against that. Or decrying what happened in Baltimore, which is also fine if you want to talk about that. But really focusing on constructive ideas that we can work together on and action in local communities. This isn't a promotion. I'm not starting a club. I'm not going to lead it. There's nothing to send in. It's not the Glenn Beck show. I'm not going to send you a pin and a card like some Father Coughlin for the current era. What I want is to see people thinking this way. I think we're, you know, in an era of forgotten presidents. I think we're in an era of forgotten Congresses, really. Essentially leaders who are shirking their duties, not because they're bad people, but because they're unimaginative and not creative, just as those leaders during the 1840s and 1850s were. They meant well, but they were blind and deaf and dumb. Things certainly got done during that time, but largely outside the purveyance of those leaders, and the things that they did were disastrous. And I think, you know, you can say of this particular time in U.S. history, from Bill Clinton on, we've made some disastrous mistakes in government, and yet at the same time, business and science are doing things for the most part outside the government. And yes, Al Gore can claim that he, you know, that the government established DARPANET, and without it, we would never have had the internet. The spiritual grandfather of the internet is DARPANET, which was, you know, a defense private sort of creation and a university creation. But at the same time, if it weren't for people like Marc Andreessen, who introduced the first browser, and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and the guys at Intel and a whole long list of these Silicon Valley people, as well as some pretty cool people in government at the time, we wouldn't have the internet today. The thing is, the things that those leaders in the 1840s and 50s could have done that they missed set the country back decades, caused millions of deaths in the Civil War, and made solving serious problems like slavery ever more dangerous to the Republic. And actually, a forgotten president following Lincoln almost ruined it in the effort to reconstruct the South. They called it Reconstruction, but it was really tyranny. What kinds of omission errors are our current leaders making? And again, these are errors we don't see, errors that they don't see, because of their lack of imagination and creativity and ability to work together. The United States is a great country. It's greater and better on its worst day than any other country in the world, I think. But we haven't cornered the market on greatness, and we can just as easily fall apart. I mentioned in a podcast previously that in about a period of, 200 years, which is really just a sliver of time for the Roman Empire, it went from being really a pretty tight republic to being a bizarre monarchial dictatorship. But what's unique about the United States is that we seem to have the ability to reinvent ourselves when we work together. Right now, we are complaining and whining. Everybody's got a problem, from the fat shaming to race to sexuality, whatever your deal is. Why don't we drop that stuff and start reinventing and rethinking and reorienting? Because when we do, the politicians get swept out of the way and really cool things happen. And honestly, I think a new era is coming. I am ready for the new, so ready for the new. And I don't see what the holdup is. Once again, I got to thank the sponsors of the Bob Davis podcast. Don't forget, you know, we talked about history and the path to personal wealth throughout history is property ownership. You just have to know what to buy, when to buy, and how to buy. And prideofhomes.com is a husband-wife licensed real estate agent team. Happy to have them as sponsors of the Bob Davis podcast and their real estate investors with expertise to share with you. Take a minute and talk with Eric and Aram Lucera with Luke Team Real Estate and prideofhomes.com. They're in the North Metro. Click on their website at the top of the Bob Davis podcast in the banner at prideofhomes.com or call 763-433-9100, 763-433-9100. And of course, Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul. This is the time to have Ryan come and check your heating systems because they can upgrade them with smart tech to make them more efficient. Even if you upgraded 5 years ago, even if you've never upgraded, especially if you've never upgraded, this is the time to have Ryan come out and check your heating systems. Call him in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Metro-wide from St. Paul. That means the suburbs too for four generation. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. They're great for emergency service as well. And thanks, Greg, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. Got to thank you guys for listening to the Bob Davis podcast on Stitcher.com, iTunes, of course, and TuneIn and BlogTalkRadio.com. And thank you for liking and sharing and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter. And again, thanks for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 410, the first podcast of the fall season, the new fall season on thebobdavispodcast.com, here in the studio.